Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline won't be joining us today, but we have a very interesting guest from Amelia Island, Florida, Christine Oshu, author of Campfire Confessions. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Christine.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. I'm so impressed with you and your mother's background. It's just amazing what you've done and accomplished in your life. I just love it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, Christine, you have quite an interesting background, too. You're the founder of the Night of a Woman's Soul, Creating Your Amazing Life workshops, and a former human resource executive with a MAIR from the University of Minnesota. She's a member of the Global Women's Club, Women in Film and Video New England, Harvard Square Scriptwriters, and other groups, and a former log rolling champion who still log rolls along with being an avid hiker, kayaker, and explorer. She's previously written screenplays and a children's book, and Campfire Confessions, she's really incorporating her love of nature and adventure. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Christine. Log rolling. How did you get into that?
Oh, I know. I just love the sport. Where I grew up in Hayward, Wisconsin, is where they have the World Lumberjack Championships. And they've done it for, I think it's been almost 100 years now. And instead of going to the swimming beach in the summer, my father and mother would drop me off with my sister at the log rolling dock. And we would just hang out there all day and log roll with our friends and then, of course, compete in the World Championship in the summer. And that was kind of my childhood until I got a little bit older, and then I started teaching and coaching. Of course, when I went away to college, it wasn't as easy to compete anymore because it's not like you can really just drag a log behind you and and pop it, like, a little cumbersome. But I've done it for a lot of years, and I started filming it, and then I kind of took a break. Obviously, I don't compete anymore, but I've gotten back into the last few years as far as volunteering by coaching and just doing what I can to support the sport. It's a lot of fun.
How many people are involved in log rolling?
Well, what you do is the sport comprises of, there's like four sizes of logs, and they're all 12 inches in length, and they vary in diameter. So they go from like 15, 14, 13, and 12. So you start on the biggest log, and there's a time limit for each log, and there's two people on the log. So you have two people on a log, and you have a center line between the two of you, so you can't cross over your half of the log. You can step in the line, but you can't step over the line. And so the goal is it's three out of five falls. So the goal is to obviously knock your opponent in the water three times in a row. But if you don't, one of the lessons that I learned that I feel like is kind of stay with me the rest of my life is if you fall in, you know, you're going to fall in eventually. You're going to get wet, right? So the lesson learned is you got to get out of the water, back on the log rolling dock, you know, wipe your face off and figure out what you did wrong and get back on the log, you know, so you just can't never give up.
And how have you used that in your writing career, that lesson?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I didn't even realize how much it affected me until I started, you know, really thinking more about it. But besides the never giving up, and I think just the joy sometimes that we have, you know, in doing something that we love and playing, I felt like it gave me three mantras almost. One was balance, because when you're log rolling, you know, you've got to, like, stay centered. Things come up and you might have to stop what you're doing. Like, it took me 5 years to write this book. And, you know, if I had, my mother fell and broke her hip, you know, and I had, was a caretaker too as she passed. Also have grown children and actually grandbabies now. So if someone needs me, I like to go and be there. So the writing stops for a while, but it's okay because that's kind of balancing your life and your priorities shift. So balance and log rolling is key. Focus was my other mantra, because in log rolling, you have to keep your eyes on the other side of the log. The minute you look up, you fall in. So I figure whatever I'm working at that moment. I need to focus on it and not worry about what I can't get to. And the third is kind of faith. You know, you just have to have the faith that you can do it, you know, and if, no matter how long it takes, just try not to give up.
So are there a lot of competitors in this sport?
You know, there, we always wanted it to be an Olympic sport. It never got there. I still feel like it really should.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people do as well. Yeah. You know, I'm not sure what the exact number is, but there's probably a couple. Well, with the children's program, there was over 100 new young log rollers, like ages 16 and under, that were involved in Hayward, Wisconsin's log rolling program this past summer. And there's different programs around the United States. So it's fun to see that. So I would imagine maybe 500 young competitors, 16 to like 5 years old. I've even seen a few four-year-olds out there. And then professionally, I'm going to guess maybe a couple hundred. And of course, then you have your choppers and sawyers and pole climbers and people who are involved in the whole area of lumberjack sports. And it's really one big community, one big family. It's really fun that way because, you know, I find myself watching people, grandchildren of friends of mine that are now out there winning titles and whatnot, and I'll say, oh, I know your father or I know your grandfather, you know, and so it does kind of go down from generation to generation.
Wow. Are there any other countries where this sport is active?
Yes, New Zealand, Australia. We had people come from Japan. Some different European countries like Germany, I believe. And so there's England. So yeah, they really is
wow.
A worldwide sport.
Wow. Yeah. So I can certainly see with all that, with all your history is in outdoor sports, why you would write this book about a canoeing trip down a river. So I'm assuming you're also a canoer.
Oh, yeah. We did it since we were little. I grew up on a lake in the middle of the woods that we were like the first family to live in a lake year-round, except on our side of the lake, and there was another family on the other side of the lake, and that was kind of it. So even in the spring, I mean, we'd be, as soon as the ice went out, we'd be in our canoes. The Namakagan River is a very famous logging river in Hayward, Wisconsin area. And yeah, you know, whenever I can, I would get out in a canoe, and most recently a lot of kayaking as well, because I can go out kayaking by myself. I can throw it in the back of a truck and go down the river and be able to lift it back in. But I've had many, many great memories of canoeing with family and friends. So,
well, one thing about in Campfire Confessions, these three women obviously are experienced canoers, but, you know, it can be dangerous. And they are kind of fearless. I mean, just running the rapids at all, you know, in the beginning, they're running rapids and banging into boulders and like, just like brushing it off like it's no big deal.
Yeah, I think it's just like, you know, it's one of those things, if you've done it since you were young, you don't have the same fear. It'd be like starting, you know, like if you got in a ski slope, you know, and you've done it since you were 5 years old, you're probably not going to have that same fear. But if you get out there, you know, in your 40s or something, and you're, you know, standing on the top of the hill and going, oh, my gosh, you know, there is that different, you know, fear factor. But I have to admit, when I got back out in a kayak and a canoe, even just recently, if there was some big rapids, there's been times that I've been a little nervous, you know, if I'm honest. Yeah. And then you just kind of go with it, and you realize that if you bang into a boulder, you know, you're going to be okay. It's not high-level rapids like you might see on a sporting channel.
Okay. So, Christine, what inspired you to write Campfire Confessions?
Well, you know, I really felt that we were lacking of a fun, entertaining, uplifting, kind of funny story for women. It felt like it had been a long time since I personally read a book that made me laugh out loud and was really engaging and uplifting. I just felt like I was just reading a lot of books that were very serious and dramas, or and the world just kept getting more and more serious, and you know, COVID hitting, and just you know, all the things that we've had in our country and other countries around the world. And so that was part of it. I was just wanting something that was fun and entertaining that you could escape into in a unique setting. But at the same time, I really wanted these women to have these inner struggles that I believe women, you know, and men struggle with, such as, you know, learning how to embrace self-love, learning how to let go of their past mistakes, learning how to forgive themselves and others. And so I wanted to weave that within the story, and also put some action adventure in there so it would be, you know, different. And so I was looking for something that was unique and different, and I think I got it.
Well, I had another guest recently who wrote a detective, Paul Merrill, who wrote Fast Food Detective, which is a comedy detective novel. It is very challenging to incorporate comedy into, well, actually, any kind of comedy novel is hard to do. Romantic comedy is probably maybe the easiest in some ways, but even that's a little tricky. But anytime you're trying to put humor into a novel, it's a challenge. So how did you decide, you know, what was funny, what wasn't, you know, how were you, how you were going to do this? Are you you know, a fan of stand-up comedy, or, you know, what's your comic background?
That's a great question. Thank you. Well, one, I think I have a good sense of humor. I'm not always one who can sit there and crack jokes, but I can play off of someone else's sentences and get some of the witty banter going. I do love stand-up comedy. I mean, any chance I get it, you know, to see somebody in person, of course, that hasn't been as common, but hopefully, you know, it will be again. I would just be the first in line, or, you know, love watching it on television. So I definitely appreciate that. But I think because I had some really unique girlfriends in my life that were very funny, and when we would get together, you know, we could just kind of play off each other and, you know, make fun of ourselves and tease each other. I also have three sisters, so when we get together, there's a lot of teasing and nothing ever hurtful, which I think is kind of a gift, because sometimes when people tease, they can be hurtful and not always funny. But, you know, we were able to always find that fun balance, and especially when you make fun of yourself, you know, you're pretty safe in that. So I really think I took a lot of that. And I actually did have a reader email me the other day, and they said, I loved your book. I had it on the plane, and I started laughing out loud. And, you know, the passengers around me were kind of looking over to see what I was reading and what was going on, you know, because you don't see a lot of people laughing out loud on a plane. And so, and that has been like a comment I've heard more than once is, I actually had a high school classmate email me the other day saying, I said, what did you like best about the book? And she said, I haven't laughed that hard for a long time.
Oh.
So, yeah. So I, you know what? And I also worked very hard on it. I mean, I rewrote scenes over and over and over again, you know, to just really kind of get the timing, to just make it real, to make sure it was kind of, you know, that it was staying genuine to what the characters would do. So,
I mean, the book starts out very serious. There's, with the incident that kind of sets everything off, and with one of the characters, Annie, and the other two, Joe and Sandra, although they're also dealing with something serious, you actually present it in sort of almost a farcical element to their problems, in a sense. So, and it's interesting because I hadn't really thought about this, but as I was reading, there's a lot of these three friends who have reunited are there's a lot of teasing and razzing, and that I, in my experience, don't find that women can often, that women have that type of relationship with other women very often. But you apparently do.
I think there's that, but I also think that there is a lot of new love and support that, you know, they, as they transition, you know, they start to really get into, you know, and they just kind of do it in a more humorous way. And I guess that's part of, like, when you think of, like, Sex in the City, sometimes there was a lot of banter or whatnot. But, you know, I think that I definitely tried to make sure that there was this unconditional love and support that was part of it. But I'll say, too, that, you know, I run into women, and I would have to say, I wouldn't know what the percentages would be. I'll say 50-50, that 50% of women do have some of these childhood friends, and they stay close to them, or maybe it's a group of college friends, and they're able to go on these trips together once a year, or do these, you know, reunions, and they have so much fun. And, you know, personally, I do that with my sisters, and, you know, we have a lot of fun. But I do think it's something that I've had envy of at times when I haven't been able to connect with my sisters, and I hear some other friend is going off with her college roommates, you know, or their childhood friends. I'm like, oh, you know, I want to do that too. But life, you know, just couldn't do that with my different responsibilities at the time or whatever. And so I do think it's something women kind of crave, and, you know, if they don't have it, they would like to have it. And one of the passions of writing the book, and I just did a book club last night where I went and we talked about it, is to try to create a community in different ways for women to connect through this book, whether it's through virtual book clubs, which I'm, you know, planning to put out there and encourage other women to do, but I'll host them as well, and different mini events where women can learn how to reach out to each other and start to build friendships and relationships. And how do you do this? And how do you make new friends? And so this was a big topic of conversation last night. And some of the advice the women gave was, you know, you have to be a friend. You have to work at it. You know, maybe you need a volunteer, find someone who shares your interest. But you know, sometimes it takes a little courage too to put yourself out there and, you know, and start to send an email or follow up with a text or a phone call, and, you know, that we need to find ways to support each other.
Thank you. You're listening to Christine Oshu, author of Campfire Confessions, and this is Writer's Voices. I definitely hear what you're saying. I don't have those sort of childhood friend groups or high school or college, because we moved across country when I was in ninth grade. And so that sort of terminated my earlier childhood friendships. Although I'm still, you know, with Facebook and stuff connected, but, you know, there were so many years where I didn't, and I missed a lot of the things that where you really form memories in high school with that group. And then I wasn't in my new town long enough to really feel, to really develop those either. And then I dropped out of college my freshman year to get married and have a baby. And so I didn't have that opportunity either. And I do have great friends. I have really strong women friendships, but you're right. Those memories from the early years and there is something really appealing about that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. One of the ladies last night mentioned that she never had, you know, like a lot of friends. And there was a big period in my life, too, where I didn't have a lot of friends. I was a single mother for almost 10 years, and I was working full-time as an executive in HR. And I didn't have anything, you know, time to do anything but just kind of, you know, work and take care of the children and do the best I could as a single parent. And, you know, I found that it was later in life where I started to really develop deeper and closer relationships with some friends, and then recently kind of reunited with a few childhood friends and kind of restruck that friendship back up again. And one of my childhood friends said, you know, she said, my goal for 2022 and the rest of my life is to cherish my friends more, to take time out for my work day and to make sure I reach out, because she said she realized that how much she needed that in her life, you know. So, you know, I think every woman has a different experience with that, and it's kind of nice, no matter where you might find it in your life, that maybe if you find it in your 50s or 60s or 70s, you know, it's still so rewarding.
It is. It's true. And the other thing that we don't often talk about that isn't addressed very much is friend breakups.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Very painful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have experienced that. In fact, I have a memory that came right to my mind. And it was a very complicated story. You know, she, through a lot of different complications, you know, it just kind of had some, you know, just that kind of friend breakup. And I was devastated.
Yeah.
And I remember it took some time to heal over that. And, you know, and it does, because the friends are other people you open up to and you trust and you're vulnerable with, right?
Right.
And, you know, then it's almost like a trust has been broken, and does involve some, you know, healing and some forgiveness and all that.
Sometimes a friend breakup can be as difficult to emotionally as a romantic breakup.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good point. And then how do we heal that, right? And how do we get over that? And, you know, finding ways to, you know, fill ourselves up with self-love and being kind to ourselves. And, you know, and I think being able to talk about it with other friends and getting that support you need. And maybe those friends aren't always like friends, but it could be, you know, someone in your community, or even someone in your spiritual community, whether you go to church or not, or, you know, but what I found amazing is when you start to mention these things and you take that risk and you feel like you're putting yourself out there, that suddenly, like, let's say you're in a group of 10 women, and let's say you're talking about depression even, and you say, I'm feeling that, you know, I start with depression, you know, I'm working my way through it. I would say 5 out of the 10 other women in that group will say, you know what, I have depression too, or I had my bout of depression, or I've been there, I understand. And I think that's one of the things I wanted to accomplish with this book too, is to kind of get away from the stigma of some of these things that we're afraid to talk about, you know, like with Annie and some of her issues in the book, you know, with starting with some depression and whatnot. And, you know, that, you know, let's get rid of the stigma. Let's, you know, because it's really amazing how many women struggle, and men with this issue, and even loneliness. The latest stats say that over 40% of people globally are experiencing loneliness.
Oh.
So, yeah, yeah, that's so, yeah, I think there's a lot of richness in this discussion that we're having right now.
Yes, exactly.
You're really making me think.
So, Christine, tell me a little more about these workshops, The Night of a Woman's Soul, Creating Your Amazing Life. Is this something that you do currently, or is this from the past?
Yeah, you know, I taught my first one in 2018, and I did it up in Hayward, Wisconsin. And actually, it was after I went through 2 different operations, and I just felt really out of whack myself. And I've always been a pretty positive person and, you know, picked myself up and kept going. I was in a good marriage. I remarried, and, you know, I was in a good marriage and a good place. But these surgeries just kind of knocked me backwards. And I've always studied, you know, I'm a lifelong learner. I just love psychology. I have my BA in psychology, and I love human development and human potentiality, I'll call it, and areas of quantum physics and neuroscience and our brain and, you know, all that kind of motivational psychology. I'm just like, give it to me. I'll just eat it up. But so when I went through this kind of my night of the women's soul, I will call it, where I woke up one day after the second surgery, I had a complete hysterectomy. And I just felt like so sad and so blue. And I'm like, what is wrong with me? And I didn't know, you know, and I went from a number of doctors and, you know, and they were trying to figure out, you know, how to rebalance my hormones and my body and all that kind of stuff. But also, you know, it was more than that. I had to kind of go back on my own journey and say, what haven't I addressed in my life that is maybe making me sad? And so I, you know, met with a counselor and she gave me great advice on self-love. She's like, you know, I think, Christine, that you've been so busy all your life that now that you've had to like sit in a chair and heal, that some of these things have kind of crept back up that you may not have dealt with, but you know, look at them with love and treat them with love and, you know, and do a nice thing for yourself. And so I continued to study and I said, you know, I want to give back to women and share all this wonderful knowledge that I gained because I, you know, I worked myself out of it and I used all these tools that really just really, you know, just made my life so much, so wonderful. And so I created this course called Creating Your Amazing Life, and I taught up in Wisconsin to start. And I wanted to present it there first. Besides being my hometown, I felt this knowledge about the law of attraction, you know, what you put out, you get back in. What is really the power of positivity? Understanding that we're all really energetic beings. So we have this energy field around us, and actually they are able to scientifically measure now even the frequency of our thoughts. Certain instruments that, you know, outside of our body that can measure kind of the waves. And so just to understand that we're all these energetic beings. So if we put out the positive energy, that's kind of what we attract back. And I think that we can all kind of say, yes, you know, we kind of know that, you know, if you're positive, you tend to get positive things back and all that. But then the bigger part is, okay, set your intentions. That was one part of the workshop. You know, are they clear? Do you see them? Do you feel them? Are your senses involved in it? And then what are the tools we can use to keep on track? You know, self-talk, different techniques, energy tools, even including tapping. And, you know, what are some obstacles you're going to overcome? So just to circle back is that I wanted to give this to these rural community of women that may not always have the opportunity or the financial resources to go someplace and take our workshop for $1,000, you know, for the day or whatever. So I just, you know, said, hey, for $25, come on in. And if you can't afford it, you know, let me know behind the scenes and you can come in for free. And, you know, we sold out. And then I went on to teach it down in Florida. And then COVID hit and I taught it virtually. And then since then, I've taught it just segments of it, still virtually. I'm involved with some different groups that are international as well. So sometimes I'll get a call, hey, can you do a 45-minute, you know, workshop on how to raise your vibrational energy? How do you, you know, kind of get your body feeling better and your mind and spirit? And so I love doing it. And I'm actually through this book, it's the workshop's going to reemerge and, you know, maybe a little differently. I think some of it will be the same, but I would like to break off certain segments and, you know, share as much as I can, whether it's, you know, I think it's yet to be seen, but it'll be fun, whatever I do. We have a lot of fun things planned.
Now, it's, you make it sound like it was all so easy. No, like the developing this course and getting people to come and then getting kind of a worldwide reputation for it was like no big deal, but that's a really big deal.
You know, it's, I work really hard. I do. I am a worker.
But how did you attract attention to this program, like internationally? How did you do that?
Yeah. Well, you know, part of it was, I do put myself out there and I do love people. So I'm not afraid to talk to basically anyone. I mean, and I see them as, I would say like characters are welcome in my world, you know, as long as they're kind. And, you know, so I think that I just, because of that, I tend to just, you know, I'm not afraid to reach out. And I think I just kind of, you know, put out there a little bit, you know, in my prayer, my thoughts, you know, what I need. And I look for the doors that open, and I think that that has served me well. So if a door opens, I tend to go through it and make the phone call, send the email, you know, reach out. Let me tell you, it's not easy. I mean, there's times too that I struggle or I get tired. I have to refuel. Even with this book, sometimes it's a lonely journey, you know, when it comes to marketing mm-hmm. and putting yourself out there and all that. And it's not easy. And everybody has told me, even with this book, you know, don't be, you know, disappointed. It takes a lot of effort, energy. You know, there's rare successes to get it out there. And it's all true. It is very difficult. But when a new writer comes to me, I figured, you know what? You know, I'm just going to encourage them. You know, if they love their book and they love their story, I'm going to say, you can do it. You know, you know, let's lift each other up, because it is hard. And so I've been lucky. People have supported me, but I'm still working at it. I mean, I, you know, I woke up this morning worrying about something. And I said, you know, what are you really filling your mind with? You know, what about all these positive things that just happened? And why not assume the best here? So I had to work on shifting my thoughts, and that's where all these tools come in so handy that I've worked on for years. But it's been a lifetime journey, so don't let me, it sounds easy. It's been a lifetime. It's been a lot of years.
I understand that completely. Now, in Campfire Confessions, you bring a lot of these concepts, these, you know, what we used to sometimes refer to as New Age ideas, mm-hmm. although you don't hear that so much anymore, because now it's more main, they're all more mainstream.
Yeah.
But and of course, I'm here in Fairfield, Iowa, which is the center of the Transcendental Meditation community. So it's, you know, I'm very familiar with all of these concepts. But you're also utilizing some traditional religious and spiritual concepts too. You know, traditional Christianity and even older, you know, traditional Native spirituality. How did you learn about the Native spirituality?
So I started really diving in. Well, I grew up next to the Ojibwe, one of the Ojibwe Nation tribes there. And I want to make sure that I give them the proper credit here, because they definitely deserve the proper credit. So I grew up, you know, in the middle of the woods. And I think it's just spirituality. And that comes naturally to me. But I also was raised in a Lutheran church. And my dad taught confirmation classes, and, you know, we never got out of any church service unless we were really, really sick. And had to went the whole route, church choir, you know, and everything. So, you know, from A to B. And so, you know, church was very important in the family. And in fact, my dad used to read us out of the Bible after dinner every night. And I used to love it because I was younger and I got to take my turn reading, and my older sisters were just like cringing, like, oh, can we get this over with? But I think, you know, so that part of it came, but then also living in nature, just being surrounded with beauty and, you know, living on a lake and in the forest. I mean, just kind of all that just in front of you all the time. And then of course it was the Couderay Oriel's band, Lake Superior Chippewa, the Ojibwe tribe, is just a couple miles from my house. And so I grew up with a lot of the Native Americans from that tribe, who are just beautiful, lovely people. And I started studying the cultures probably in my 20s, and would always, you know, pick it up and study. Ted Andrews has a beautiful book called Animal Speak. And I don't know if you've ever seen that book, but I actually brought it to my book club last night. And it talks about just, what different animals and birds and reptiles and insects represent to different cultures and Native Americans, as well as all cultures around the world. So I think it's just been part of my life and part of my research. Mm.
Christine,
I just love reading about it.
Christine, why don't you read a little bit from Campfire Confessions?
Oh, absolutely.
If you'd like, you can set it up, you know, to describe who the characters are.
You bet. So the story is about, you know, three best friends with three big secrets. Your life seemed perfect, but of course, you know, that's deceiving appearances, right? And so when Annie's secret explodes first, she's the wife of a small town minister, and that's located in like Hayward, Wisconsin, first where the book is set. She ends up in the hospital after this accidental overdose. I will give that a little bit away since I think that's also been explained a little bit on the cover of the book and whatnot in the descriptions. So they've been on the river for a couple of hours, and she's along there with her best friends, Josephine, nicknamed Joe, and Sandra. And Sandra and Joe are trying to get Annie to open up and share what happened and why she was feeling depressed, and they want to help her and support her. And so it's a process of getting her to open up. So they are just kind of shared some banter with each other, and they're feel like Annie has just started to open up. So we'll start with that. So they're paddling in the river. So Sandra stopped paddling, allowing Joe and Annie to get closer. Her turn. Here's my Joe. She paddles really slow. Sandra dips her paddle in the water and splashed Annie and Joe. Their faces. The shock of the cold water would wear off. Better get away before they retaliated. Sure enough, Joe and Annie worked hard to reach her, but no problem. A piece of cake to keep enough distance. She relished the frustration on Joe's face. Come on, Annie, smack her with a song, Joe pleaded. There's Sandra and Joe. Where did they go? When I needed them. Shoot. Don't make them feel bad and bring down the mood. Hey, I'm sorry. It's not your fault. True, but we should have been there for you, Annie. I'm sorry, Joe said. Yes, a breakthrough. Sandra backpedaled to join them. Annie, I'm sorry, too. We're here now. We want to talk to you. But girls, I have an emergency. I really have to pee. My bladder is about to burst. Please help me find a spot. Pronto. I can hear the rapids coming up, all that jolting. It won't be water in the bottom of the canoe if I don't get relief. I thought I would do something funnier. What was that phrase? TMI and Hank was hip, Joe asked. I did hear that Sandra fell into Hank's arms at the baseball field. Annie looked over at Sandra. Wow. Sandra was squirming like gnats were biting her. Maybe they should stop. Have some mercy, Joe observed the marshy banks. You didn't pick the right time to have an emergency. Excuse me, who knows when they're about to have an emergency? She's got a point, Annie said. I can relate. Just look for a shallow spot. Anything, I can squat. I've got strong quads. There, Joe pointed to a small mound of earth covered with long grass and broken branches, an oasis in the middle of the river. Sandra clenched her core muscles and powered over to the island. She made it. Alleluia. She scrambled out of the canoe and pulled down her pants. Sandra, stop. Look behind you, Annie shouted. Sandra turned. No way. Her heart thudded. She wanted to shout, but her tongue wouldn't move. A huge beaver with enormous teeth and angry eyes, swimming right at her, full tilt, leaving a motor-sized wake behind. Why? She looked to her side. The pile of branches mixed with mud. His done. Oh, shoot. Why weren't her arms and legs cooperating? Move. She never felt so uncoordinated. She stumbled around, pulling up her pants before tumbling backward into the water. She struggled to get up, but her pants slid back down. Joe and Annie's howls of laughter thundered in her ears. The beaver was getting closer, its menacing teeth barred to attack. No time to waste. Sandra pulled a canoe off the island. Her paddle slipped out and floated away. No! She lumbered after it, her wet pants hugging her knees, hindering her progress. She finally grabbed it. A loud crunch behind her. The beaver? Her body froze. A jab of pain. The canoe rammed into the back of her knees, tossing her into a deep hole of water. Sandra felt strange, a lightness under her feet. She'd been spared from crashing on the rocks. But how? The beaver? She scanned the water, nothing. Gratitude filled her body and acted as a life jacket as she bobbed around. The underlying current dragged her back into a shallow, sandy bed. Stand up and act cool. right, as if that was possible. She wavered between being pissed off and enjoying the hilarity of what had just happened. There really wasn't a choice. It had been an incredible comedy act, one that couldn't be reproduced. Joe and Annie caught up to her, tears of laughter streaming down their faces. Stop! I still have to pee. Hey, Annie, do you know any good jokes? Joe asked. My last knock-knock joke wasn't very funny, Annie admitted. Actually, my muscles are clenched from being terrified. It's going to take the rapids to loosen me up. There's a spot right after the rapids where we can stop, Joe said. Annie, what do you think? I think watching her run from the beaver, pants halfway down, was the funniest thing I've ever seen. Sandra, if you could have seen your face. I've seen enough scary pictures on my face lately. I don't have to imagine. Impossible, unless someone played a trick on you. Why had she let that slip? Sandra knew better than to give them any clues. Their minds were sharp. Getting bitten by that beaver would be more pleasant than admitting what happened. So there you go.
And that was Christine Oshu reading from Campfire Confessions. See, that would have been enough to get me off the river right there.
And actually, that didn't quite happen, but there's a little bit of that that happened between a friend and a sister, so then I added some imagination. But...
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there were quite a few animal encounters in here. Now, did the beaver have a particular message, a particular meaning?
Yes, it does. I can easily look that up for you. In fact, I think the beaver is a very interesting animal, and I love studying different animals. So, the beaver is kind of it's known for building of dreams. It can teach you lessons about breath and its control for the greatest health and effectiveness. It lives in the water, right, as well as land. So it's associated with emotions and with dreams. One of the most common dreams that the average person has, to have a home and family. And I guess the beaver embodies that. If a beaver has appeared in your life, it can be reflect an opportunity to build upon your dreams.
Wow. Well, I just heard a news report about these beaver meadows in Colorado.
Oh, neat.
That where they've had the Colorado wildfires, that these places where the beavers had built out all these swamps and tunnels and from one place to another, that it would be like green oases in the middle of all this fire damage place. The fires did not touch them because the ground throughout was so wet. So have you, said that that experience was one that a friend of yours had. There were a number of very treacherous, dangerous experiences that these women faced. Are any of them things that you actually have experienced?
Yes, there is that scene where Joe flips with her kayak and she gets stuck between the kayak with the branch, you know, pushing it down in the bottom of the river. And, you know, she thinks she's going to die. And I actually had that happen to me. I had torn my ACL in half. One of our rescue golden retrievers had run behind me and my bone popped out and tore the ACL and popped back in. So I was wearing this huge brace on my leg for the summer, but I wanted to go kayaking, so I grabbed my brother and we took our kayaks and went on the Namekagon, and we're going on the river, and my venturesome spirit said, oh, the right side looks like more fun, it's faster water and whatnot, and so I was ahead of my brother, and I got sucked into this huge branch that had fallen in the side of the river by the riverbank there, and the current swept me into it. And I thought, oh, no big deal, I'll just push off. Well, the current was stronger than I realized, and I had a really hard time pushing off. I couldn't move, and the kayak started to tip, and the water started pulling over, and it was just seconds that it just became this gush of water, and I flipped. And I was basically stuck between, you know, the tree branch and the bottom of the river. I was eating sand, basically.
Oh, my.
Kind of, yeah. And I tried to get out, and my brace caught in the lip of the kayak. And so I couldn't get out. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to die here. And, you know, what about my husband? What about my kids? What about my grandkids? And I just said, okay, you know, just let go. And I basically just kind of relaxed and everything got really, really quiet. And I just ended up somehow putting my arms out, and the current just slowly sucked me out of this. And I just didn't even really know I was out. I just felt myself suddenly floating on the bottom of the river. And when I surfaced, I was probably, you know, 25 yards down from where I was trapped. And yeah, and then the kayak got loose and kind of knocked me behind. Yeah, and I crawled to the riverbank, and of course my brother paddled over, just horrified. He had lost me, and we celebrated. And but yeah, I shared that story in the book and gave it to one of the characters. And I'm much more careful now than I'm going down the river. I have to say, yeah, I do watch out for that. I try not to take the same chances. And I have kayaked by that spot a number of times, and I give it a wide berth.
Well, I don't have much experience canoeing or kayaking, but many years ago, my ex-husband at the time, and I went on this nighttime moonlight canoeing trip with some friends who were more experienced at a river right near the house we lived in March in Iowa.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Cold water.
Very, very cold water. And my husband's was in a canoe with another guy, and they ran into some debris in the middle of the river and flipped the canoe. And so the rest of us, there were, I think, three canoes altogether. So the rest of us were trying to rescue them and, you know, got them out, and we pulled over at a sandbar near downriver a little bit, and we were getting out, and I was up on the bank of the river, and one of the paddles was floating by, and I reached out with my paddle to try and snag it, and I slid straight down the bank into the river, into the water, over my head, when the water was probably in the, you know, less than 40 degree temperature.
Oh, that's scary.
That was a shock. Yes.
I found water when it's that cold, and you realize how people can drown because you can't move your arms. How did you get out?
I wasn't very far from the sandbar, and so I was able to get to it. But it was a shock for sure. So in this case, these adventures, these near-death experience in some cases really caused some soul searching and some introspection and some insights for your characters. Did you find that true in your life too?
I think so. Yeah, I think just that whole lesson of letting go, especially of past mistakes, things like that. You know, I think by the time you get to, you know, your 50s or whatever, that, you know, if you've lived life, you know, there's things that you might regret or mistakes or things you could have done differently. I'm very, pretty self-critical, and I try not to be. So that's always something I'm working on, and I've gotten a lot better with kind of going to self-praise more than self-criticism. I think we all need to do that. But so part of that was for me too, is letting go of past mistakes. You know, it doesn't serve you, you know, we all get a chance to evolve and move on. The past is the past. But it's, you know, we can say that, but sometimes it takes more than the words to be able to do it. And those are things that I know that you practice meditation, I believe. Am I correct on that?
Right, right.
I saw that. Yeah, I'm very impressed with what your background and other companies you run and involved with. And so, I mean, there's different things like meditation that can help you too with that. But yeah, I think definitely the letting go and also gratitude, you know, like, you know, just that fresh surge of gratitude, because once again, we all know we should be grateful, and we might do our gratitude exercises and whatnot, but when you have those like extreme moments of gratitude where it just really hits you in the gut and the soul, you know, those are can be those life-changing moments. And, you know, and we can, when we can like hold on to those as much as possible, or remember those, you know, like, gosh, you know, that bring that gratitude back in your body, or bring that love back into your body. And, you know, I think those are the powerful stories that we need to keep.
Oh, definitely. Christine, tell me a little bit about your background in screenwriting.
Oh my gosh. You know, I always wanted to write since I was little, and instead I went into, you know, psychology and human resources and whatnot. And I got married fairly young as well. But when I remarried and had a chance to basically pursue my creative interest and left the corporate world of, you know, where I was in human resources, and really started my dream of screenwriting, because I just really saw things as movies, you know, very visual. And I studied in Boston with the Harvard Square Screenwriters Group, and I went out to LA and Beverly Hills and did all kinds of courses out there as well, and conferences and workshops, and just fell in love with the whole genre of screenwriting. So I started writing scripts, and I had written six. I have four by myself and two with my sister, Lorraine Lacey, who's also written screenplays. And she actually had one of them produced, Christmas Mail. And so basically studied the craft, and I went out and pitched a number of times. I was fortunate enough with a few to one screenplay in particular called Nantucket Or, where I had a number of options along the way, you know, where a producer would, you know, give you a certain amount of money to hold on to the script so they could maybe see if they could get a budget behind it, or actors and actresses. But when I was in that world, it was a very, very tough world to get into. You didn't, it was over 18 years ago, and you didn't really see all the independent channels and opportunities that exist today. And, you know, so I did it for a number of years and loved it. But eventually I thought, okay, this is a little bit of a black hole. I think it's like 3% of screenwriters break in every year, or get a new screenwriter that's not on staff or isn't already hired, that really get into, that make it. So those are pretty tough odds, right?
Yeah.
But once again, you know, you could be one of those 3%. But so I ended up picking up a camera because my sister and I co-wrote this script called Lumber Joe, which was about this young teenage log roller who, along with her brother and best friend, had this like log rolling, Paul Bunyan type of log rolling show, Trick and Fancy, we'd call it, where you jump rope on the log and twirl hoops and things I used to do in my youth too. I had with some Trick and Fancy act. And they go to Hayward, Wisconsin to try to win the big prize money. But when they get there, the event's been eliminated. So they have to compete in individual events. Where the reigning champions all want to sabotage them. So we really thought this was going to make it, right?
Right. It sounds amazing.
yeah, thank you. Yeah, and we had an agent and everything, and you know, she pitched it, and we had a lot of interest. But I think it's one of those timing things, you know. One producer said, I filmed something recently in the woods, and I don't want to go back into the woods. You know, too many mosquitoes, I think was her word. And, you know, it's very family friendly. And, but so what I ended up doing, I picked up a camera and said, well, I'm going to film a trailer on this and try to see if we can get more interest by sharing what the lumberjack, you know, world was about, log rolling. So I ended up doing a lot of filming, and it turned into doing a lot of work, for the community and for the log rolling and lumberjack association, where I, you know, film for them and give them, you know, material and different competitors. I would film things for them. And then I did some other projects, community projects and, you know, small projects, and, you know, founded my own company, Wendigo Productions. And I had a lot of fun with that for a number of years, but it also kind of became a black hole of, you know, money and whatnot. But what a great learning experience is. And I think like anything, you know, the screenwriting and the filmmaking, you know, I met people, I learned how to be a better writer. I learned how to see things visually. I understood the world of filmmaking. So all that played into, you know, writing this novel, you know, just because I the writing. I like fast writing. I like it being fast paced, like a screenplay would be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not a ton of description. So you'll find that the book tends to read pretty fast because there's not a lot of description.
Right.
You know, some people like a lot of description. Everyone's different.
Yeah.
But for me, I kind of wrote it visually as I saw it. And but the treat was being able to share the emotions that the characters were feeling, Annie, Sandra, and Joe, because you can hear their inner thoughts in the book, where in a screenplay, you have to show it. You can never tell it.
Right, right.
And so that was a learning curve.
You know, and the thing about screenwriting, of course, if you manage to be successful and get a screenplay made, you know, it has probably a much, for most people, a wider audience than your average novel will have. And, but it's dependent on so many people being involved, yeah. And it often changes and gets and morphs into something maybe different than the author originally intended anyway. Whereas with a book, today, in today's world with, you know, print on demand technology, especially, you can make, you know, it's all on you if you want it to be.
Right.
Yeah. You can get your book out there in the world. If you choose to do that. Now, what was your publishing experience?
You know, I ended up going with Books Fluent and Books Forward, which is a hybrid publishing company. They're absolutely wonderful to work with. I had an excellent team. I self-published my children's book, No Pooping on the Deck, in 2018. I wrote it in 2017 for my two granddaughters that were having a meltdown, and I was babysitting them. And I made up this story about this owl that was on our dock because they love this statue of this owl, and they like to play with it. And they asked me, you know, Grammy, you know, why do you have an owl on the dock? And you might have this in Iowa too, but obviously anyone who lives in the lake and has geese around and ducks around know that they love to come on your dock and poop, right? So the owl tends to scare them. So I told this story about this duck, I mean, this owl that became magical every morning, and he came alive, and he'd go down the dock, and he's willing to share his dock with the ducks, but he had one rule, no pooping on the dock. So, you know, one by one, the loony, wacky, naughty, and crazy ducks came up and broke the rule until I had to chase them away. So so that was that. But that man, my daughter ended up calling me saying, Mom, you have to write this book down because I can't tell it right. And the kids are mad at me every night at bedtime because I don't tell it like you do. So I ended up writing it down. And I had a friend, Robin Marcus, who helped me, you know, with the illustrations and was a great coach. She's a beautiful artist. And so I ended up self-publishing. It wasn't the goal in the beginning, but after I just did all this work for it, I said, well, why not self-publish it? But it did get me into to understand how much work it is to self-publish and also to market. So with Campfire Confessions, you know, I had a choice to go traditional, to go independent, to go hybrid, to go with a small traditional. And I did have a chance to go with a small independent agency. And I did have a chance to really query the traditional because I did have a lot of encouragement to try to put it in front of a traditional publisher. And I started that journey, but I was into it maybe for a month or 6 weeks. And I think after all that screenplay rejection and just all that hard work that it is to query and work. I just said, I can't do this. I want control. I want to work with the team. I have dreams of it being made into a movie someday, and I wanted to retain the rights if that could ever happen and have some say. So I went to hybrid, and I'm grateful that I did. It's been a lot of work still. You still have to do a lot of work yourself. I know, but the fun is you have a lot of input. You know, you're working with professionals that know what they're doing, and they save you from making mistakes. They do a lot of the work, but you still have your creative voice, which I really loved.
Well, that's a very good recommendation. And I think, you know, the book seems to be very well edited and very professionally done. So I think you were successful in that. And we are out of time. We always close with a quote, and I found one that I think is really perfect. It's from Herman Melville, Moby Dick. He wrote, "I know not all that may be coming, but be it what it will, I'll go to it laughing."
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. See you all next week on Writers' Voices.